Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Where will the photographs we take today be a century from now? The technology of today's digital world will certainly be obsolete. Think 8-track tape, floppy disks, and Kodak film. How can we preserve and store today's photographs and all the other digital data we are gathering so that it's accessible to the next generations? Joining us to discuss digital archiving are Chris Martinez, the Manager of Media Archives and Digital Assets for the Missouri History Museum. Robert Manley is a digital asset coordinator for Washington University Libraries. Vernon Mitchell is the administrative lead for DocNow and curator of popular American arts, archives, and special collections at the Washington University Library. He joins us by phone. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here.
Good to be here.
Robert, let me start with you. Given the digital formats of today, this day, mm-hmm. and the hardware and the software that's out there, they all tend to change very quickly, as we know and have seen. How do you keep ahead of this?
How do I keep ahead of it?
Yeah.
I think in terms of like what we do at the library is that I think we want to store the files in a very secure and safe location. And that's part of staying ahead of it because at least you know they're not going to corrupt, they're not going to degrade, they're not going to fall apart because it takes a lot of time to assess what you have and then also what you don't have. And so moving forward, when you do have the time, then you can pull them out of storage and you start to work on them. You can take a look at some of your formats and say, like, you know, I have these image files in TIFF. And you can know, like, without a doubt that those are probably going to be okay. And there are certain checks that we do called checksums, which you run through the system that kind of create a DNA sort of blueprint of the file. And you can get reports and it will tell you if something's changed about that file, I can get an email telling me something's changed about that file. So it's just a matter of monitoring them.
And when something changes or it looks like it's going to change, what then?
I think you pull it out, you have a look at it. Sometimes it's not as drastic as you might think. You also have to take a look at your storage, what happened in your storage that would have caused that problem, and then, migrate it to a new format. And you can also, there's some of those corrections that you can make into the file themselves.
Yeah, but the new format, however, is the question mark at the moment because we don't know what it's going to be.
Right, yeah, right. Exactly, yeah. There's a lot of stability out there, really. I mean, in context, I think TIFF file is a very very stable format for images, as well as, say, PDFA for documents and things like that. So, I mean, we move into safe spaces, and put our files in there. And then, you know, like, that way, at least we're prepared for the future and what's going to
and
come.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Exactly, yes.
Chris, what are you doing at the museum? I know you've been active in preserving the material you have over there, which is considerable. How are you doing it?
Through digitization for two reasons, for preservation and accessibility. And what we do is similar to what Robert was saying. We have systems in place that ensure the security of the files. So some of those measures are things like redundancy, meaning that the file exists in many formats, and preservation is a part of that. So we would have a file that we keep for preservation and those that we use for access. That way we ensure the fact that that preservation file, the one you always want to go back to, is always secure. Planned migration, think about the future, you know, look ahead in five-year terms. Think about where the industry is going. Are these file formats going to be accessible or available in 5 years? And if it looks as though that they may disappear, then you plan a migration, you plan a reformatting of those files. And then quality control, as he said, things like checksums to check that. It doesn't ensure that the file will be safe. It measures decay, but you can plan for some of that decay through, like you said, redundancy and replication, having the file exist in more than one place.
This is the thing that kind of mystifies me, though, when you talk about looking at files that may disappear. How do you determine that?
Well, that's a good question. You keep your eyes open. as technology changes, those things change. We hear about it all the time. But what is the average consumer supposed to do? I think that, like we had said, you know, look ahead and think about reformatting those files if they're valuable. I think there's always some assessment that has to go on as to how valuable are these images or these documents to you. Are they worth saving?
Pardon me. You've been working at this for some time now. Have you had to make any changes in format?
Not yet, no. However, some of those things are, you know, they're on the horizon. As an example, what we use for standard definition format as a preservation format is a 10-bit uncompressed QuickTime. That's a very proprietary format. That's something we try to keep away from in all aspects of preservation like this, is to keep away from proprietary formats, go to more open sources, things that are more universal that can be used on more than one system or all systems. And if you may have noticed in the news that Windows no longer supports QuickTime codecs. So that's not a very universal format. So we have to plan a migration to another format.
Yeah. It sounds fairly complicated to me, but you know, this is your area, not mine. But it seems like you really have to be on your toes 24/7. Let me turn now to Vernon, who, as I indicated, was on the phone. Vernon, tell us about DocNow and what you're doing.
Okay, so the program I'm working with is called Documenting the Now, DocNow for short. It's a Mellon-funded program that is a project, I should say, that is a collaborative endeavor by three institutions, the University of Maryland, University of California, Riverside, and Washington University in St. Louis. Together we've come pooling our resources, I should say, in some ways, via the Mellon Foundation, to really look at digital preservation in terms of social media. And this all culminated coming out of the of 2014 and the death of Michael Brown and the uprisings in Ferguson. As we all know, Twitter, Vine, Instagram became very important tools for the community, for activists, for scholars, for organizers. And this was an effort on our part to preserve that moment as much as that was possible, with being aware of keeping in line or keeping a thought about, you know, each of these accounts, Twitter accounts, is attached to a person, right? This is a human being that's sending something out. And so what we've done, or what we're doing, this is the second year of the project, which will, you know, end 2018, is putting together an archive of 12 million plus tweets that will a user, patron or researcher, scholar, et cetera, student, will be able to use the suite of tools we'll create to kind of sift through all of these tweets to curate their own moment. And so that's what I've been working on there. And I have my two other colleagues, Burgess Jules and Ed Summers, respectively, who are at Riverside and then in Maryland. And we've been working on this to have something that will be functional and thinking more so not just about the academic side of it, that's one part of it, but also the community side. So what does that mean to preserve history? Right, because now this is a brave new world. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you would only be looking at the personal documents or the congressman, right? You would only look at his congressional record per se. Now you have a Twitter account, right? You have a bunch of other things that have changed that landscape, and even in our own personal lives, this is all part of what we do. I mean, for instance, think about what the world will look like 20 years from now, when we think about things that have been used, like to do genealogy, for instance, all that stuff will change. I'm looking, any of us that are talking right now in this conversation will look at, we'll go back to records from 100 years ago, right? But what would it look like when you start sifting through Twitter and Facebook and these types of things to find genealogy? And that's kind of where we are right now. Those things are occurring. So DocNow is trying to join this burgeoning field of information technology, you know, study of information systems, to see how can we keep and preserve these historical moments with the type of integrity that is beneficial to the community but also for those who want to do research.
I understand what you're saying. And my question, though, concerns what happens. And obviously, a lot of work is going into this, given all the volume of the material you're dealing with. But what about 10 years from now? Who is going to be custodian of all of this? And as the formats change, as technology changes, who's going to be responsible for keeping these files up to date and current?
We all kind of will be doing that. One of the things that we worked into the grant was to make sure there wasn't a preservation or a curation of this project as it moves forward. And as we, again, like a decade from now, what does it look like? That's something we'll have to we'll keep crossing that bridge as we get to it. We don't really know right now, to what Chris was saying. You know, it's really kind of open-ended, so you want to make sure you don't use proprietary systems. You want something that's going to be open and available to everyone. But, you know, at this point, we don't know what we don't know. We just try to stay ahead of the curve as much as possible.
Chris, one thing that occurs to me is concern for security, because we've all been reading about hackers and people who are very adept at getting at information like this. How do you secure it?
Well, that's a little out of my wheelhouse, frankly. We have a robust IT department that really handles all of that, but it really gets down to that. And a little to Vernon's point, I think that we are all going to become archivists and digital asset managers in the future. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, again, I think we are responsible for in a way. And as consumers and as people producing content, the more content the individual produces, the more they're going to have to manage it.
You're confident your material is safe from viruses and things like that?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. We have a very good IT team, good IT department that takes care of
that. The same goes with Washington University Libraries.
Well let me come back to you, Robert, on that. And I understand what the libraries are doing and the need for doing what you're all doing. But I kind of lost my train of thought there. Here it is. I understand what you're doing, but what about medical records, insurance files, and companies and corporations that have all of this data that they must conserve? How are they going to do that, and how are they doing it? Are they doing the same thing you're doing?
I think they are, but at a much larger scale. I think in the library community, sort of the understanding of digital obsolescence and the nature of digital files, like how they're going to be corrupted and degrade over time, and then also like the nature of how our collections were changing. You know, primarily we were dealing with like paper documents, photographs, and things like that, and had a well-planned out preservation and archival process. But with digital assets and digital files, that all changes. So we're really just really trying to get into it at this point. I think there's a lot of conversation. There's a lot of communities being built around this so that librarians can have this skill, because I think a lot of us don't come from those same technical backgrounds that, say, people at corporations can get, because they are well ahead of where we are. Because we use a lot of open source tools, a lot of community based tools, people pulling their resources together so we can all figure this out.
Is there ever going to be a day when we're going to want to find information, or someone will want to find information that is supposed to be there and it's not there?
Absolutely. I think it's happened to me. For sure. I mean, I definitely.
I'm talking on the grand scale, the insurance company that loses all of its records.
Right. Ideally, I don't think they want that to happen.
Of course.
Yeah. It's certainly possible, for sure.
It is. Mm-hmm. We've got to take a break. We'll come back and continue this conversation. I'm talking with Chris Martinez, Manager of Media Archives at the Missouri History Museum. Robert Manley is Digital Asset Coordinator at Washington University Libraries. And Vernon Mitchell, also associated with DocNow at the Washington University Libraries. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation about the storage of digital information. I'm not sure which one of this gentleman this question should be directed to, but putting it on the level of the everyday folks today, using Facebook, let's say, a lot of digital memories are being stored on Facebook, family photos, baby's photos, the grandkids, and all the rest of it. I go back to the potential for losing this. Do any of you know how that can not happen at some point. Robert? Chris?
Robert? So we use a web archiving service at Washington University called Archivit. And I can go in and capture Facebook pages. I mean, there's a lot of content in there. You don't want to crawl too far, but you can. I can like go in and capture content, whatever is publicly available. I can capture that content. On the back end, just in preparation for this show, I went and started exploring some of my own sort of digital assets that Google and Facebook have, and I went in on the backside. And there are ways to download your data. For instance, I did download my data from Facebook on Friday. And I'm still waiting for an email from them today. It's telling me that my data is available to me so I can review it and see exactly what kind of file formats are available to me, what they have, and then what I could actually do with it. So you can, I've only been on there, I guess, 10 years, and I'm not very active, but it seems like it takes a long time.
Well, what about someone who is not as conversant with all of this as you? Me, for instance.
Facebook has plenty of instructions on how to do it. The question, though, on the other end is what do you do with it? Just in downloading some of my Google information, I got a lot of file formats that I don't think, you know, like you would know what to do with, and that would take some special software to deal with in order to extract that information and use it personally. It's obviously better to use it in Google because that's what it's designed for, but you can take it locally and work with it.
Chris, what I'm thinking here is that a lot of people who are really not up to speed in all of this, I'm talking basically about older folks who are wary of the technology anyway and maybe just getting into it, that they're not going to be able to handle this and that these precious photos and what have you will be lost one day.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. And there are other things you can do, like Robert said, you can download your data, you can download your information and store it yourself. But you can also donate it as well. That's another method.
You know,
that's
donate
it. Well, that's what we do. We preserve materials. We preserve information. We preserve ideas. We preserve letters. We have an archive. We have that's very, very big, robust. And we do take digital content, as I know Washington University does. And that's one method because this is the business that we are in. We preserve material, digital material. As well as 3D objects and papers and books. So the possibility of donating it to an institution if you think it's valuable. But I think, again, what you were saying, you know, we've become very prolific as creators with our photos, with our emails. It's a challenge, and you can download it. You can save it. To sort of address one of your other questions that you had about how is our material secure, one of the ways that we do keep it secure is it is not accessible to a public. It's not accessible to an outside line. It's not accessible to where a hacker could get to it. That's another method of keeping it secure. You could download your data. You could download your photos. Put them on an external source where it's not accessible by someone else and keep it secure yourself.
Mm. Vern, I'm going to turn to you. What advice do you have for Granny who uses the computer only to email the grandkids and send occasional photos. But she wants to preserve those so that when the kids grow up, they have them.
Well, first I would talk to the grandkids and her kids and make sure that they get Granny as literate in this, you know, new world as possible.
They probably already are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some grandparents are doing very well. But I think the thing is to save in many places as possible. I know at the university, that's a mantra that we have about, for those of us that are working in archives, is to save in multiple places, multiple times. I have hard copies of everything that I've done. I have hard copies of all types of things, but I also save in different places, so it can't be corrupted. But to the grandmother, cloud devices, cloud services are working really well right now. And it really just kind of staying in tune with what's happening. And again, and this goes to the grandkids and the children of said grandmother, that they kind of keep abreast of what has Granny produced, right? So the part right now to what Chris and Robert are talking about is to make sure that as content creators, we're kind of aware of what we are creating. We're doing it at a prolific rate, but how do we preserve it? And the only way we're really going to be able to do that effectively is together. So help Granny out in as much as that's possible.
Robert, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think one of the more imminent dangers are actually storage media that people have lying around their house, old digital cameras, old SD cards, old computers, and say they never got their content off of there. And that stuff over time will break down. Mm-hmm. And then as it breaks down, it becomes harder and harder to actually access your files off of that. And so if you do have old cell phones, like Granny has an old cell phone that she used a few years back that wasn't attached to the cloud, it may have a lot of the files that she took. And so I think it's more important to get on that phone while you still have the cords and have a computer that could read it and get those photos off of it, because, you know, those may be important.
Vernon had a sentence a moment ago in which he said the cloud is working very well right now, which would indicate that, you know, perhaps it won't be working so well down the road. Tell us about the cloud and is there any way at all that we can protect ourselves through the cloud?
And I'm not an expert at all in this regard, but I will tell you this. There is no such thing as something that is 100% safe, okay? As reliable as cloud services have been thus far, they are not beyond being corrupted, right? So, again, I think we have to save in our media in various places. It can't just be in one place. Now, the cloud, with the new security systems that have been are they being used currently, they're pretty safe, right? You know, but nothing is 100% safe. So there's always the potentiality for something to be corrupted, to Robert's point. So I think you have to have multiple saves of your more precious materials, and as technology changes, that you stay ahead of the curve as much as that's possible, so you don't lose anything. So you get to a place, as Robert was discussing, where you have outdated tech that you can no longer use, right? And that's one of the things that at university we've had to do with the Film and Media Archive is dealing with this all the time. Going from reel-to-reel, VHS, Beta, you know, Laserdisc, and trying to get that stuff digitized so that patrons can use it, you know, 5 or 6, 10 years, 20 years from now. So, but it's an ongoing process, staying afloat with technology is a process, and it takes time to be involved in that way so that you can preserve your content.
Is there an analogy in talking about preserving this stuff and keeping it secure in, you know, the insurance company that's got all this information about us and necessary for their business, that they run the same kind of risk if there were a fire in the building, that information could be lost, that the same kind of risk applies to the digital world? Do you think that's an apt analogy, Chris?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
That there's always going to be risk, and there always has been.
There is, but fortunately, we plan for those things, correct, through redundancy and replication, migration. Those things ensure the fact that it lives in more than one place. It's insurance that we always have copies of it somewhere, and that we can always – disaster recovery is also a big part of that, planning for a disaster. The way we do it is through what we call a dark archive. We archive our preservation materials outside of the workflow that we have established. We preserve it on tape, and we keep it in a safe, and we keep duplicate copies of it in other locations.
I have a caller here I want to get in because I think he raises an interesting question. It's Jerry from O'Fallon, but Jerry, it's got to be fast. We're running out of time.
Yeah, very quickly. I transferred some photos from my camera card to my computer, and in the process of transferring them to a memory, to a flash drive, they were not lost, but they were wildly distorted in a very – So I've always felt, you know, digital either works or it doesn't work. It's A or B, but this was like the strangest thing I think I've ever seen, which is, puts me in doubt about the, you know, the validity of digital storage or transference.
Thank you, Jerry. We've all been through that in one way or another, haven't we, Robert?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the first question I would ask is, how long did these photos sit on this card and this camera, and where was this camera stored? Because that's like the most important part, because that camera got hot, exposed to heat, and things like that. those files could easily become damaged, because those sound like corrupted files to me.
This is something that people generally don't know, that they have to really be careful with their devices, because that's how the information
exactly can be corrupted. Like digital files, they need constant management. Oh, I think you always have to attend to them. You can't expect that if you just set it on the shelf and then pull it down in 5-10 years, it's going to be accessible and be working, because most likely it's not.
Temperature, things like that can all have an effect. Time is running out, but I have a quick question back with Vernon, with what you're doing now with the Twitter feeds from Ferguson. Vernon, is there an ethical issue here? You know, I'm thinking of storing this material. If I have my picture was taken throwing a Molotov cocktail in a police car, and somebody took that and put it on Twitter, and now you've got it and you're going to preserve it. Is there an ethical issue here? Because I don't want people to see that, or my kids to see it 20 years from now.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're really working on. We're having a advisory meeting in December 10th to the 12th in St. Louis to discuss these very things. The ethical considerations about preservation are at the forefront. And to the question that you're posing directly or hypothetically, we're concerned with that. So, for instance, if there was a user that was prolific, or someone says, hey, Vernon, I don't want my Twitter feed to be part of this collection, we won't include it. We want this not, you know, for us, it's not just about studying this data, but it is about preserving it for the long term and preserving it with the content creators at the center. You know, so in that case, we would, if a Twitter user said that they didn't want their feed used, we would not make it accessible. Because, again, these are people that are tied to all these accounts. They aren't just robots, right? These are actual individuals. So we want to make sure that we keep that at the forefront of what we're doing while we also try to preserve the historical moment.
Robert, in your work, aside from what Vernon is doing, are there any ethical considerations that you have to work with or work around?
I think most of that is like during the accessioning process.
So what process?
The accessioning process. So
what is that?
When we bring a collection in, basically you outline with the donor, you know, what are the limitations, and then take a look and see what's in copyright. So I think those are basic considerations. But in terms of like digital archiving the web and things like that, I haven't run into any.
How about you, Chris, and the work you do is it's quite different, but are there ethical considerations that you must face?
There are, with legacy materials. And as you said, you know, I completely agree. It's in the accession process. I think, but to another point to that as well, which is that as we become, social media personalities, send out tweets, you know, personal responsibility. But what we do is out there in public. People see it. It does get preserved. And that's something to keep in mind when you're going to send a tweet or take a photo or post something, that it can be preserved indefinitely.
The way people are using social media today, I'm sure not a lot of thought is being given to that. I want to thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with us. Chris Martinez, thank you for being with us from the Missouri History Museum. Robert Manley, thank you so much from the Washington University Libraries. And also, Vernon, we want to thank you for being with us as well. Vernon is joining us by phone. Vernon Mitchell, that is, also from Washington University Libraries. Thank you all so much. Much more to talk about. We'll have the conversation again, I hope. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.